You're listening to the podcast of the musictherapyresearchblog.com. Today's podcast is with Dr. Julian O'Kelly. Dr. O'Kelly has worked in neurorehabilitation and palliative care as a music therapy clinician, manager, educationalist, and researcher for the last 15 years, and regularly presents at international symposia and conferences. In addition to his research work, he is an expert panel member in acquired brain injury for the NHS National AHP Clinical Expert Database, an active member of the Society for Research Rehabilitation, advisory board member for leading arts therapy provider Chroma, and coordinates the Music Therapy Neurology Network JISCMail Forum. During his recent post as PhD Mobility Fellow with Aalborg University, he published several peer-reviewed papers from his doctoral research on music therapy with disorders of consciousness. These papers have garnered considerable interest from healthcare and neuroscience professions alike, including invited presentations to symposia in America, Canada, and across Europe. In addition to his research work, Julian chairs the scientific committee for the forthcoming international conference at the RHN Music Therapy Advances in Neurodisability 2 and is associate editor of a special research topic for the open access publication Frontiers in Human Neuroscience, titled Dialogues in Music Therapy and Music Neuroscience, Collaborative Understanding Driving Clinical Advances. We'll include some links for Dr. O'Kelly's work, and we hope you enjoy this podcast for the Music Therapy Research Blog. Blythe and I are happy today to be joined by Dr. Julian O'Kelly. Dr. O'Kelly, would you start with just a little background on how you got into the profession of music therapy and specifically when you recognized you had a little bit of a penchant for research?
Yes, hi, Andrew. First of all, let me say it's a pleasure and an honor to be invited to speak on this podcast. I've been looking at your previous episodes. There's some really useful stuff there for the profession, so it's a real honor to help contribute to it. But in regard to your question, how did I get into music therapy? I suppose you could trace it back. I did a music degree, but fell out of love with it and moved into the social sciences. But perhaps as many of your listeners may have experienced, if you have music in your blood and you're doing a job that doesn't involve music, you kind of want to find your way back. And so I did, through various routes. I was involved in teaching and performing. But eventually I heard about a course at Bristol University led by the great Leslie Bunt that was part-time. So at the time, you know, I could really afford a full-time training, and it enabled me to get into the profession that way. And soon after that, I was lucky enough to get a full-time posting in palliative care, which was quite new. We're going back 15-odd years now in the UK. And being new in the field, there was a need for evidence-based practice, and the hospice I worked at down in Devon in the southwest of England supported me on doing a master's in palliative care at King's University in London on a sort of part-time basis. So that gave me the kind of the basic tools you need to do qualitative and quantitative research, and I got that buzz from having my first publication, and that really set me on the path that I'm on today. Sort of moving on from the coalface work and realizing that as a clinician, I can combine that with research skills to really help sustain the profession in the world today, where evidence-based practice is so important and organizations are often cash-strapped and they need that knowledge that they're investing in something that is of proven worth.
Thank you for telling us about your background. Can you tell us a little bit about your current area of study?
Sure, yeah. I'm currently involved in work with patients, to use the current terminology, in disorders of consciousness. And that basically encompasses patients who are in vegetative and minimally conscious states. So generally, these are patients who have had severe brain injury, either from a traumatic origin or through oxygen starvation, anoxic injury, where it's very difficult to tell whether they're aware of their surroundings, of others, of themselves. And you can adopt, obviously, some very sophisticated fMRI technology to brain scan and see if people are responding to commands. But it's long been thought that music has powers to reach these individuals, to provoke an emotional response, and to actually give us a feeling as to whether they are actually aware of their environment. And what I was aware of going back 4 or 5 years ago when I started working in this field was that there was very little evidence, again, despite there being many stories in the press of miraculous occurrences of individuals coming out of comas when they heard their favourite piece of music, sometimes even a pop star performing to that patient in a hospital. And that slightly irritated me, because I thought there must be some way that we can evidence this miraculous occurrence. And so I put these ideas together. And at the same time, there was a research fellowship with Aalborg University, which I was fortunate enough to receive an award to pursue the research on a full-time basis for 3 years. So my work now is really just an extension of that. I'm looking at what impact it might have on rehabilitation.
One of the interesting things that you're doing in that work on the publication side of things is working with the journal Frontiers in Neuroscience. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about what a huge collaborative effort that is, all the different contributors, guest editorship of the research topics and everything. Could you sort of expand on that and clarify that for the audience?
Yeah, I'd love to. Basically, my relationship with Frontiers came about with the main publication for my PhD. It's really chimed well with a research topic that was about at the time, led by, among others, Dr. Teppo Sarkomo in Finland, who'd done a lot of work with stroke patients and music listening. Mm. And Frontiers is under the Nature Publications umbrella, so it tends to produce high quality, high impact publications that are open access, which, for those who are not familiar, means you can basically, anyone can download these papers around the world. So they offer a really good medium for dissemination and impact for your research. So I published in this series that was led by Teppo, which had a number of more neuroscience-y type papers involving music, not necessarily with clinical applications. And I was really bowled over by the popularity of the paper. It's actually the most popular in the series of 19 that came out on that topic. And they asked me to put together a topic myself. And the way Frontiers works is it tends to pick, say, an emerging voice, if I may call myself that, and encourage them to team up with more established voices in a field. So I got together with Marie Tervenamy, who's a leading music neuroscientist, who's looked at music perception, cognition, early childhood development, and Professor Jörg Fackner at Anglia Ruskin, who's done a major work looking at EEG measures of depression with music therapy. So they're the two more established voices, and we've set up a topic called Dialogues in Music Therapy and Neuroscience. And it's doing really well so far. We've got a deadline of the end of the month, so there's still time if anyone wants to submit an abstract. But we actually have 43 contributors who would like to be part of that topic.
And along with that, as far as getting more information out to people, I hear that there's a conference that you are a part of.
Oh, you are wonderful. You give me two plugging opportunities. Yes, indeed. Yeah, the other, I guess it's in the same vein. It's Dialogues in Music Therapy and Neuroscience. This is Music Therapy Advances, and it follows on from a conference we put in 2013 here at the Royal Hospital for Neurodisability, where I wanted to again attract music therapists, but also music psychologists, neuroscientists, all working with a shared goal of using music to help people with clinical need, traumatic brain injury, autism, learning difficulties, and so on. And so this is a follow-on from that, and we have some great keynotes. We've got Felicity Baker flying all the way from Melbourne. We've got Jörg Fackner, I've just mentioned, and Marie Tervenamy, who are my fellow associate editors, and I'll be saying a few words too. And we've just received the abstract, so it's a bit late for you to submit for that, but certainly not too late to get the early bird for that. And we've got some really nice abstracts to sift through and find some good ones for oral papers and poster presentations.
I remember when you're saying some of these names, they really are international leaders for not just music therapy, but the broader topics that you're talking of, which is what I enjoy. Sure. It was 2010, I think, that Blythe and I were at an international conference that happened to be in Seattle for Music Cognition and Perception. I remember seeing Jörg Faulkner's work. I remember seeing some of the other people that you're talking about, and I remain really impressed at the kind of work that's happening internationally and everything. I'm really excited to see what comes out of this. I'm wondering for you, because just based on your work at the Royal Hospital for Neurodisability, could you take us through who you're working with there, what different professions, what sort of how are you combining sort of the clinical things that you're doing with the research that you're doing there?
Yes, of course. Yeah, the Royal Hospital for Neurodisability has two parts to it. It has the short stay rehabilitation side, where patients are funded by their local health authority or funding consortium to be here to receive quite intensive rehabilitation. It may be quite soon after their accident when they become more medically stable. And here they can receive input from physiotherapy, speech therapy, obviously help out with their social side with social work. We've got a team of medics, psychologists, and music therapy. And it was very much, I think, thanks to Wendy McGee, who's now flown at the pond over to your side, and she's at Temple now, that very much my predecessor here, that we have quite a developed and established music therapy department. There's currently, I think, five, including an assistant, that are working across the spectrum of patients with neurological disorders, from the patients I've just described to patients who are, you know, not wheelbound but may have difficulties in speech and gait and fine motor control, to patients with neurological conditions like Huntington's disease, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, and so on.
It sounds like you have a lot of experience working with a lot of different individuals. And if we go back to some of your work working with individuals who are in minimally conscious states, can you tell us a little bit more about, there's an assessment tool that you all have been using called the Music Therapy Assessment Tool for Awareness in Disorders of Consciousness. And can you tell us a little bit about that tool? You've researched it and been involved with that tool and its development, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed. Yes, it's been a long time in coming. That it was the brainchild of Wendy and her colleagues, I think some 15 years ago. She may correct me on that. But it's something that's evolved out of clinical practice and the need for music therapists to have some form of standardized way of assessing the effect of their intervention on measures of arousal and awareness, where these effects are very subtle and can be easily perhaps misinterpreted. So what's needed is a serial assessment that is undertaken perhaps in four different sessions at different times of day, so we capture the patient's different states of arousal, and that looks at breaking music down into its constituent elements. So you've got pulse, rhythm, different pitches, consonant, dissonant, the use of favorite music. So we're using the many features of music to sort of see which might have an effect and actually show that the patient is aware or not. Now, the research I've done has developed on this tool, which is now standardized and published itself. I did a paper which compared the results of the music therapy assessment to the more established assessment by the OTs called the SMART assessment. That's the Sensory Modality Assessment Tool for Awareness, I think. And what I found was very interesting. I found that the music therapy assessment tools seem to be potentially more sensitive, no surprise, to the auditory, but also the visual domain, whereas the SMART assessment was more sensitive in the motor domain. And so what you have, if you have the fortune to have the resources to have both assessments going on, is you can get a much more comprehensive picture of a patient's responses because of the particular unique characteristics of each tool and the way that music might both draw out visual and auditory responses to complement the motor responses of the OT's assessment.
I'm looking also at one of the other articles, Neurophysiological and Behavioral Responses to Music Therapy in Vegetative and Minimally Conscious States. And this was, your lead author on this, and you mentioned Dr. Faulkner, Dr. McGee, and everything. When I was reviewing it, I was fascinated by a lot of the different aspects of it. You mentioned some of these I guess you mentioned some of these different variables that you were measuring, these healthy subjects versus the individuals in the vegetative or the minimally conscious states. At the end, or at least at the one of the sort of broader conclusions was that more investigations are warranted for music therapy for prognostic indicators and potential to support neuroplasticity and rehabilitation programs. I'm wondering if you could parse a little bit of that statement, as the broader findings of that 2013 study. And we'll link this on the blog so people can check it out for themselves.
Yeah, thank you. That's really where I'm involved now. I mean, I was inspired by a paper going back, I think 2006, by Visionin et al. And she noted that patients who were in that question mark gray area when clinicians couldn't really tell if they were vegetative or minimally conscious state, when they were presented with an assessment tool, I think it's the Western Sensory Neurological Assessment Tool, it basically uses a lot of different environmental stimuli and looks for responses in patients. Well, she looked at their heart rate variability, and she found that patients that had more sympathetic nervous system reactivity to, say, familiar sounds, images, in this question mark, sort of gray area state, when you followed them along, these patients who maybe might have had an increase in heart rate or respiration in response to one of these stimuli were actually the patients that seemed to recover. So despite their inability to show their awareness through speech or movement, there's this more covert measure that seemed to be predictive. So I thought, well, we know that music is effective in evoking responses and, of course, physiological responses. So why don't in my new study follow patients along and see if they were the patients, if they did respond in such a way, whether music could be useful in this manner as a prognostic tool. So what I do is, at the moment, I'm doing what I did in the PhD study you just mentioned. I'm exposing them to music therapy, but instead of doing a one-off test and looking at their responses, I give them a sustained intervention of 2 weeks of music therapy, and I compare it to reading their favorite text. It's a crossover design, within subjects crossover design. And then I also test them at 3 months and 6 months with the same stimuli, and I'm looking to see if they recover. Are they the patients that maybe responded in a more covert way at the beginning to those measures? Now, that was one element of your question. Mm-hmm. Was there another I've just missed?
The bottom.
Hold on there.
What specifically were you referring to in terms of what are the indications for potential music therapy as supporting neuroplasticity in these rehab programs?
Oh, okay, yeah, fine. Well, again, this is inspired by the literature, and again, it goes back to the chap I mentioned earlier, Dr. Teppo Sarcoma at Helsinki. He has done a number of studies looking at stroke patients just listening to their favorite music on a CD, and again he's compared it with another stimuli of hearing their favorite books, so you can see where I got the idea. Mm-hmm. But obviously mine is in more of a live format, and he's done before and after fMRI studies with these individuals that had I think about 6 months on a treatment program, and he actually saw increases in gray matter volume in areas of the brain that might be involved in auditory processing, but also processing emotions, cognition. He also found in a range of behavioral tests that there were improvements in verbal processing. There were also improvements in mood. Now, this study used quite a homogeneous patient group who had damage either on the left or the right side, and he passed it out really well following them along. What I was interested in, though, is could a similar thing happen with my more complex patients in vegetative and minimally conscious states? They can have damage that's global, that could be, much more far-reaching in its implications. But could the principle that just listening or being presented with music, could that in itself be enough to promote neuroplasticity? Now, I don't have access to the sophisticated and very expensive fMRI technology. I do have access to EEG, so that is it's not perhaps such a specific measure of brain matter growth that you might see on a MRI or fMRI scanner. But you can see increases in the power of electrical activity in the brain. And if you can pair that up with improvements in the clinical picture for the patients, then you have, you know, a pretty good surrogate of neuroplasticity going on for these patients. So that's really this the level that I'm at. I think the other thing to mention is with these patients, often they have metallic shunts. You can't tell them to keep still, and you certainly can't fit a music therapist in an fMRI scanner. So whilst these technologies are very exciting and sophisticated, they're not necessarily appropriate for the more naturalistic elements of music therapy.
You've mentioned both interventions that have been used in studies that have CDs or recorded music, but also some live music interventions. Can you just comment a little bit about the music that you're using within some of these applications?
Certainly, yes. Well, the intervention that's on the music side that the patients are receiving is drawing some elements of the MASTOC assessment we mentioned earlier, and what I found to be most effective in the one-off studies experiments in the PhD study. So a patient will come to the assessment room, and during the treatment phase, they will receive a hello song, which I'm sure most music therapists are familiar with. But in this population, it is very important because I think you don't know what auditory processing a patient has if they're not able to show you. But you can make a good bet that they're going to be aware of their name, the commonly used phrase like hello. And if you entrain this hello song to their respiration, there's a chance you might be making a deeper physiological connection with the music you're presenting than just playing in any old fashion. I mean, the evidence on that isn't sort of massive, and I did find some support for it in my PhD. But essentially, that's the beginning of the musical treatment. I then go on to perform three of their favorite pieces of music, which have been selected by their nearest and dearest, because, again, obviously, I'm not able to ask them. And I finish off with a similar entrained improvisation at the end. And then I test them before and after 2 weeks of that intervention with the whole battery of tests, an established behavioral assessment tool, the coma recovery scale, EEG, heart rate variability, and so on. So we can see if that sustained presentation of music therapy has had any effect.
It's really fascinating to sort of try to picture it, and like a lot of music therapy interventions, it's one of those things like or a phrase we have in the U.S. here, at least, you had to be there. You know, it's one of those things like you can't truly understand sort of what's going on and really get it. But you've got these nuanced assessments and everything. You know, I'll let Blythe finish up with a more general research question. But for a general clinician question, do you have any advice for clinicians who are working either, you know, more specifically with people in palliative care versus these minimally conscious states? Is there anything that you think that, is there any sort of broad advice that you might, that might be warranted by all of your experience working with these populations?
Wow, that's a big question.
Yeah.
But there is, I think there is transferable lessons and some overlap in both populations. I think especially if you're talking about working with patients at the very final stages of a terminal illness. Often they're in and out of consciousness, and you have to be using music very sensitively and delicately to support their journey. And the entrained improvisation might well be a useful sort of concept to bear in mind. In fact, there is a whole movement to music therapy, I think music thanatology, rather, that involves the use of harp entrained to respiration. So there's that sort of crossover, and you know, there's that well-worn cliche that music is, or hearing is, the last sense to go. Well, we can't necessarily ask people in these conditions if that's the case, but my research is certainly showing that when an individual is not able to show their awareness or the fact that they're conscious, there are these covert signs. There's changes in EEG power, there's changes in respiration that show that music is having an effect, which also makes us mindful to be very careful with the music we're playing. We don't know if we're overburdening a patient emotionally or auditorily. And so I think as a rule of thumb, you need to pass all your music in reasonably small doses, bearing in mind that both palliative and the disorders of consciousness patients have very limited energy levels. They're prone to fatigue. If you even just washing a patient can result in them going from a state where they've got their eyes open and they seem to be in a high arousal state to being very tired, and other interventions are not going to have any effect. So it's structuring your input carefully. It's being aware of any contraindications to music therapy, of course. For instance, some disorders of conscious patients are hypersensitive to auditory stimuli. So it's not necessarily a place for a music therapist in that case. But again, treat each case as an individual case. You may have read a lot about the populations, but even with vegetative state patients, some of them are more responsive to one modality than another. The same goes for palliative patients. So it's reading the literature, but obviously treating each case as an individual. And we're talking general rule of thumbs for all music therapy here, but I hope that's helpful.
That is very helpful. And, you know, I have to say one of the things I love about the podcast is that I get to ask people who I have read their papers and admired this question. What advice do you have for researchers in our field?
Wow. Okay. I think you, if you want to make a real impact in research and music therapy, if that's one of the things that drives you, I think it's a good time at the moment, because I think the whole world of neuroscience, for instance, is really evolving. But what they have in us is people who can use, manipulate, whatever phrase you want to use, music, and also be involved in a human relationship with music with their clients in a way that is not possible in terms of how we might listen to recorded music in an fMRI scanner. It doesn't have anywhere near the same impact. And I think there's a challenge for both sides to develop ways of working together, methodologies that can really harness the power of music to help the neuroscientists understand how the brain works using this very dynamic tool. But also, music therapists can really benefit from what neuroscience is able to offer in terms of this sort of fine-grained analysis of brain activity. So it's a good time. That's one point. The next point, I think, is to really think of a useful research question in your field, whether it be autism, dementia, palliative care. I think there's a whole range of questions that haven't been asked yet. And once you've done that, maybe get sort of working with more established researchers, put yourself in a master's course, a PhD, really get the tools that you need, be it quantitative or qualitative methodologies, to answer that question. And that's really much what I've done in the last 10 years. And it's a really exciting journey. I always feel like it's just at the beginning, especially in this field. There's so much to learn and so much to get involved with.
The first part of that answer, I smiled just a little bit, because I recalled our 2009, I think it was, American Music Therapy Association conference had Dr. Anirudh Patel, author of Music, Language, and the Brain, neuroscientist.
Oh, yes.
Very.
Yes, indeed.
And he, yeah. I think you echoed him perfectly, which was very much like, here's the crossover, here's how to be involved with neuroscience, here's the charge to all of you. And I love that you said that, and that's all still alive too. So I'd like to thank you very much for your time today, Dr. O'Kelly. I'm looking forward to getting some great feedback about the podcast, and it was really wonderful hearing about your work. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Andrew, and thank you, Blythe. It's been a pleasure being on the podcast, and I look forward to hearing it when it's hosted. Reframe, but don't know what will be. Blossom blows around the fruit tree. Silence rules me resolutely.
For today's podcast was by artist Talk Less, Say More, and it's the title track from their album entitled England Without Rain. This has been the Music Therapy Research Podcast, associated with musictherapyresearchblog.com. Your hosts are Dr. Blythe Lagasse and Dr. Andrew Knight, music therapy faculty members at Colorado State University. Follow MTRB on Facebook and your hosts on Twitter to stay up on all the music therapy research we send out into the world. If you enjoyed the podcast, please let us know by heading to iTunes and submitting a review and a rating. It only takes a minute and helps our visibility on the iTunes page tremendously. Thanks in advance. Also, send in a comment about the podcast on the contact page at musictherapyresearchblog.com.